While you're looking that up, let me explain that having been obliged to be horizontal for the best part of a day this week, I looked very carefully at other passages, special passages for this morning, particularly 1 Corinthians 11, where we have what we call the institution of the Lord's Supper. But I've been drawn back to our passage where we would normally have been in our studies in the Sermon on the Mount, and I'm very glad to have done so. So we come this morning just to these first five verses of Matthew chapter 7. Judge not, that you be not judged. For with the judgment you pronounce, you will be judged. And the measure you give will be the measure you get. Why do you see the speck that is in your brother's eye, but do not notice the log that is in your own eye? Or how can you say to your brother, let me take the speck out of your eye, when there is a log in your own eye? You hypocrite, first take the log out of your own eye, and then you will see clearly to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Amen, and thanks be to God for his word. Do not be judges, and do not be hypocrites, are the two commands of Jesus here. Now, is it not amazing how something so profound can be stated so simply? And if you find that amazing, is it not also amazing, and perhaps even more so, that this simple and profound teaching of Jesus can be so misunderstood and so badly distorted? Now, I'm thinking of the two English words, judge not. I think in Christian circles, in church circles, these must be amongst the most often misquoted and misunderstood and certainly misapplied of any in the Bible. Judge not. It's something that is thrown at the head of people. Judge not whenever they offer any kind of criticism. Thrown at the head of people when it ought not to be so. These words are frequently misunderstood and misapplied. Now, before we turn to that, and before we try to see what these words do mean, we must find their place in the Sermon on the Mount and in chapter 7 of Matthew. You see, chapter 7 of the sermon, chapter 7 of Matthew's Gospel, is not so obviously connected with what goes before it. And it's not so easy either to see the connection of things within this chapter. It's not so easy to see that this has a structure as everything else in the Sermon on the Mount has a structure. And you and I could be forgiven for, at first reading at least, for not seeing that there is a structure here. But I don't think you and I should be forgiven if on subsequent readings of this chapter we are still refusing to see that there is a connection, that there is a structure, and that this is not just a collection of various bits of teaching brought together by Matthew and stuck clumsily together, as some people wrongly believe. So what is the connection? Well, let me remind you as to where we are. The Sermon on the Mount thus far has run like this. Christian character is what Jesus puts at the head. The Beatitudes describe the Christian and his character and his development. Then comes Christian influence, salt and light, and all that that means. And then very naturally there follows Christian righteousness, the deeper righteousness, the true righteousness, which is a matter of obedience to God in Christ, not just in formal outward things, but from the heart and from within. Then Jesus deals firstly with the religious life, pointing us again to that which is not merely shallow conformity. And then comes his dealing with our attitudes. And now, in chapter 7, he quite logically closes by describing our relationships with others. If you've still got your Bible open on the pew before you, look at chapter 7 again. This is the way John Stott sees these relationships being described. The first 5 verses dealing with brothers, our relationships with other Christians. Then verse 6 dealing with those who are ignorant and who scoff at the faith, whom Jesus calls bluntly dogs and pigs. Then comes our relationship, verses 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, with our Father in heaven. Then verse 12, our relationship with humanity, all mankind. What follows that is our relationship with those of mankind who are our brothers again, our fellow pilgrims, verses 13 and 14. Then he deals with false prophets, what we are to make of them, verses 15 through to 20. And finally, from verse 21, the most important relationship of our lives, our relationship with Jesus. Now, I'm not giving you an exact structure of chapter 7, and of course these things overlap and are interwoven, as the whole sermon is a matter of overlapping and interwoven truth, but there it is. He is dealing with relationships. And what we have then in these first 5 verses is what Jesus has to say about our relationships and our attitudes to our brothers. Now, I hope there's no one here this morning who finds the use of gender in the scriptures offensive. This is not, let me assure you, exclusive language. It's a generic term, and by brothers we are meant to understand brothers and sisters, and I hope that doesn't need to be said today again and again. This is about our relationships then and our attitudes to other Christians. Now we have every reason, we are given every reason to strive, to really work for a family in God's church. A family with one Father in God. A family who will live in harmony the way we all want our families to be, especially when they're not. A family at peace within itself. Now, while we have every reason to work for that, and we're called to do that, we also have no reason to be surprised when it's not the case. When I was looking at 1 Corinthians 11 this week, again, you know, the thing that jumps out from the page there where Paul is speaking about the Lord's Supper is the fact that he's saying these things because the family was divided. Because the church was full of divisions, schisms, and heresies, he says. So while we must look for and work for unity in the church, we must not be surprised to find that sometimes it's hard to find. Now Jesus here anticipates the problems and the tensions that there will be in relationships. He anticipates those times when Christian will find his relationship with another Christian strained and difficult. And he is not condoning this. Neither is he condoning the things that cause these divisions. But he wants us positively to live at peace with each other. And that's a teaching that goes right through the New Testament, and the Old for that matter too, that we are to seek unity and peace within the family of God. And so he tells us what we must not do, be judgmental. And he tells us, on the other hand, what we must do, that is, be caring. And be supportive, even when we find faults in others. This is then his description of our relationships with each other. And he points us to two equally unacceptable alternatives. You must not fall into judgmentalism, he says, on the one hand. Neither, on the other, must you fall into hypocrisy. And he then offers us a completely different way to these two, which is the way of grace. Do not be a judge, he says. Now, there are two basic ways to misunderstand this. You remember we spoke about various people's attitudes, famous people's attitudes to the Sermon on the Mount when we began these series together. You remember also that we mentioned, amongst others, Leo Tolstoy, a man for whom I have a great deal of admiration in some things. Tolstoy himself had a great deal of time for the Sermon on the Mount and believed it was indeed a pattern for life. But he thought that Jesus here was saying that we ought not to have any law courts or judges and no juries, because everyone had sinned and therefore no one could stand in judgment at all of another, literally. Now that is foolish. That is very obviously foolish, dangerously foolish. Jesus is not speaking about legal matters here at all. It's not on his agenda. He has nothing to say to the law courts. He is speaking to Christians about their relationships. Once more, you see, it's so easy to miss the point. This has nothing to do with courts and judges and juries and lawyers. This is about our personal relationship with another Christian. But there is another basic misunderstanding, and it's far more common. It is very common. But if anything, it is even more stupid, even more wrong. And it's the idea that Jesus is saying here that any kind of criticism, that any kind of negative assessment of someone else's actions is prohibited. Therefore, Christians, some people say, mustn't ever say anything bad about anybody else. They must never say that what they're doing is wrong. They must never voice these thoughts. They should never think them. They must just put up with everything and accept anything. Now that is wrong. And that is dangerously wrong. How are you going to recognize a person who, in Jesus' own words, is a pig? Not mine, these are Jesus' words. How are you going to recognize someone who, in spiritual matters, is a dog? Verse 6. If you don't use the critical faculties God has given you to see right and wrong, light and darkness. How can you be salt? How can you be light in the world as Jesus has called us to be if you don't use your ability to assess and understand these things and be critical of sin in yourself and in others? Look at the way Jesus so robustly condemns hypocrites and exposes them as religious humbugs. Of course we are to use our faculties of criticism. Of course we are to identify wrong in our lives, in ourselves, and in others. And we are to name sin as sin and condemn sin as sin when we see it, and when we see it operating in individuals or in groups and in the church. Are we to stop discerning good from evil and say, I'm sorry, I can't judge. I mustn't judge anyone else's actions and I mustn't say anything about their motives. I just can't do that. Now that is wrong. That's a foolish distortion of the teaching of Jesus. And that's taking the two words, judge not, and making them mean something Jesus clearly does not mean. And when we do that, it makes us worse hypocrites. And if it doesn't make us hypocrites, it makes us inactive, useless, disobedient, and uncaring. How can we put Jesus' command to be different? How can we obey Jesus' command to act differently in this world? That is, differently from those who belong to the world, whose hearts belong in the world. How can we adopt different attitudes and put those attitudes and values into action if we suspend our judgment and refuse to be critical? We are meant to use our sense of right and wrong and speak out. We have to recognize sin firstly in ourselves. We have to see hypocrisy in our own lives. And then be able to see sin and hypocrisy and Phariseeism in the world. Of course, in the spirit of this, and following Jesus' own wide acceptance of sinners in mercy, with a tremendous openness to the person while the doors were closed to their sin, we should be slow to judge. Slow to judge. That is, slow to condemn. I have to confess, and probably you do too, that I am far too quick to jump to conclusions and judge people's actions. And I'm also far too prone to swing to a negative, critical attitude about people. And that is condemned. But that's not what Jesus is speaking of here. Jesus is not saying we have not to recognize and name wrong as wrong in ourselves and in others. It's this censorious condemning of people, this gratuitous, spiteful condemning of people that Jesus is roundly putting down. It's our ability to put the worst possible construction on everything that he's attacking. It's a temptation to put somebody else down all the time, usually doing it, of course, because in our own hearts we are not convinced that we're right with God, and we're doing with our guilt what we should never do with it, dumping it on others. You see, it's this poisonous, disagreeable cocktail of unpleasant things that Jesus is addressing. The attitude which makes harshness acceptable, and almost a sadistic enjoyment and a self-excusing in hurting others. I'm sure you know people who constantly undermine others, who discourage all their efforts, who have an unforgiving attitude to other people's mistakes, and I'm sure if you're honest you can recognize something of it in yourself. But there can be, and there is such a thing as constructive and helpful criticism, which is mixed with encouragement for others and thanks for what they are doing well. That's not this sour-faced negative condemnation that we find here. I think Paul is very aware of these verses that we have, or at least of the teaching of these verses which we have here. Listen to what he says to the Romans. Who are you to pass judgment on the servant of another? Who are you to do this? It is before his own master that he stands or falls, and he will be upheld. For the Master, capital M, the Master, is able to make him stand. Now, you see, that's the essence of this judging others. That we are not called to judge others whom God has pronounced to be forgiven. That we are not called to put them down and to criticize them. And yet we are to see faults and failings and sins where they exist. The paradox is that this attitude will bring judgment upon ourselves. Again to the Romans, Paul applies it like this. You have no excuse, O man, whoever you are, when you judge another. For in passing judgment upon him, you condemn yourselves, because you, the judge, are doing the very same things. And what was it Jesus taught us to pray in the disciples' prayer? Forgive us our debts as we are forgiving our debtors. Do not be a judge. The other half of it is, do not be a hypocrite. Now again, may I remind you, this is about our relationships one with another. It's about our attitudes to each other which result in certain actions. It's about what we ought not to be doing and about what we ought to be doing. Now I hope you see from the New Testament very clearly that Jesus has a lively sense of humor. And he has a strong sense of the ridiculous, and he uses it tellingly. Think of what he says about camels and needles and gnats and camels and wine and so on. And he's doing the same here. He's pointing out how ridiculous it is to be a hypocrite. Imagine the would-be doctor with a plank in his eye trying to take a speck of sawdust out of the patient's eye. There, says Jesus, is my picture of the critic and the judge who has in his own life and his own heart the same sin but 100 times worse. Don't be so ridiculous, says Jesus. Hypocrisy is ridiculous. Be slow to judge. Be slow to judge, you who are followers of Christ, not just because you're fallible, which you are, because you yourself are fallen. You know, it's axiomatic of human nature, therefore it is true of us all, that we are slow to blame ourselves for the same things we are quickly condemning in others. Therefore, Jesus, knowing this, says, be careful. Isn't it also sadly true of us? But when we condemn other people, we can find ourselves actually judging in them the sins we know deep down are in our own hearts. And there's always a danger of displacing our guilt and putting it onto someone else, of trying to put ourselves up by putting others down, of trying to make ourselves feel better by making someone else feel worse. Therefore, says Jesus, here are 2 things to do. And the first is to get the log out of your own eye. The second is then and only then to take the speck out of your brother's eye. Do you see? Here's another false interpretation that kicks around here. It's the interpretation that ends up by saying that Jesus is telling us that we ought not to see any faults in our brothers. We ought not to notice it, and we certainly ought not to try to do anything about it. Now, can I point out to you that Jesus is saying the opposite here? He is saying you've got a responsibility first to do something about the sin you find in yourself, but you also do have a responsibility about the speck in your brother's eye, verse 5. You have a real responsibility for your brother and sister. You have a responsibility for them when they have moral problems in their lives. But only do so. Only allow yourself to speak at all when firstly you have examined your own heart and brought your own sin to God. We are responsible, Jesus says. we are responsible to do something about our brothers and sisters when they have problems. Jesus here is not saying, don't do anything about someone else's problems. He's saying, my command is that you do something about someone else's problems. But don't be a Pharisee. Don't be a hypocrite. And don't condemn someone for something that's worse in your own life. The positive is that he's commanding us to correct each other in love. And the background to all this is the background, of course, of forgiveness. Do you see? We need each other. We need to find the help of God in helping each other. And what Jesus is saying is clear. He's not saying at all, shut up now, don't criticize, don't look at someone else's problems, pretend you don't see. Because that's just not to care. He is saying, now care for each other, but don't be harsh. And don't be a hypocrite. You know, the golden rule is looming large. What's the golden rule? Verse 12. Whatever you wish that men would do to you, do so to them. For this is the law and the prophets. And here, at the beginning of chapter 7, Jesus is anticipating the golden rule. This is how we are to be with each other in the church of Jesus Christ and within a Christian fellowship. Caring enough to help with the problems of discipleship and obedience, but gentle and forgiving and loving with it, not harsh, and not as hypocrites. Now, can you see how all of this morning is calling us firstly to examine ourselves? Judge not. Don't be a hypocrite. Look for the plank in your own eye. Can you see that? How we are being called to examine our own hearts as we come to the table today. Let's take time to do that as we come now and as we sing this hymn. Let's take time and ask God to forgive us for our harshness and to deliver us from harsh judgments of others. To show us where we are being hypocrites and to free us from hypocrisy. Why are we coming to this table? We are coming to this table because we are sinners. We have been forgiven once and for all through the death and resurrection of Jesus Christ. We are cleansed and given new life. But we come to remember that we are sinners who are forgiven by grace. We come because we are called and commanded to do so. Do this in remembrance of me. And as we remember the suffering of Christ and the cross of Christ, let's remember that that was because of our sin. Let's remember also his call to follow him. We come to the table because here we confess Christ. You are showing the Lord's death until he comes, says Christ. Do you remember? Whoever confesses me before men, I will confess before my Father who is in heaven. Whoever will not confess me before men, I will not confess before my Father who is in heaven. We come to this table because we proclaim his death until he comes again. You know, this is the most joyful, this is the most delightful, the easiest part of our confession of Christ, to come to this table. We come to the table because we need strength. We need bread for the wilderness journey. We need strength for the life of discipleship. We are on a journey if we are Christians. And here we come to receive by faith the bread of life himself. For he is our strength. We come to this table because here is a very special meeting place, not just of God's people. But here the redeemed meet the Redeemer again. We come to this table then asking God to draw near to us as we examine our hearts and seek to be free of harshness, seek to be free of hypocrisy, seek to come humbly. The hymn is number 311. Tune merit in number 420. 311, My God, and is thy table spread?